democracy is promoted and protected against disinformation and against subversion campaigns.
An enduring global security alliance. It's Tuesday, April 13th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online. You can find us at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, John Bolton tells VOA about North Korea, pros and cons for vaccine passports, preparing for Mars flight. It's all on today's VOA Asia. NATO is marking the 72nd anniversary of its founding. Henry Ridgewell reports the military alliance faces enduring threats across Europe and new challenges beyond into Asia.
It's 72 years since Western allies signed the Washington Treaty in 1949 to create NATO, based on the principle of collective self-defense. Russia remains its biggest challenge, says analyst Jonathan Isle.
We have a Russia which is not only willing to use force in order to threaten other European countries, but has actually used force and has forcefully annexed a bit of a territory of another country into itself as little as less than 10 years ago.
U.S. President Joe Biden has reaffirmed America's commitment to the organization. His predecessor, Donald Trump, once called NATO obsolete, which sent tremors through the transatlantic alliance.
The arrival of President Biden in the White House has, at a stroke, removed all such doubts.
Biden is also pushing for NATO to tackle other strategic threats, notes analyst Simona Saw.
Climate change cooperation as it pertains to security and defense, but even more broadly than this, technology, a new approach to Russia and China, approach to a new approach to how democracy is promoted and protected against disinformation and against subversion campaigns.
NATO faces numerous challenges, including ongoing violence in Afghanistan. Continuing attacks are complicating efforts to end the almost 20-year NATO mission. Also, internal tensions are simmering, not least over defense spending.
More than 90% of the people in the European Union, they live in a NATO country, but only 20% of NATO's defense spending comes from NATO EU members.
The United States will likely maintain pressure on European members to meet the defense spending target of 2% of GDP made at the 2014 NATO summit in Wales.
President Biden was one of the architects of the Welsh Defence Pledge. So in this sense, he is very much attached to the idea that Europeans have to invest, to continue to invest more in their defence.
Meanwhile, Turkey has purchased a Russian missile defence system, to the dismay of NATO allies.
Even Turkey does not believe that it will be better off outside NATO rather than within the alliance.
Despite the tensions, NATO remains the bedrock of European security as the alliance enters its 73rd year. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Myanmar's junta levies new charge against Aung San Suu Kyi. Myanmar's efforts to control COVID-19 crumble since February coup, according to aid groups. Japan begins COVID-19 vaccination efforts for citizens 65 and older. Mekong dams bring hardship to Thai villagers. Matsuyama becomes first Japanese golfer to wear Masters green. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also check us out on Twitter and at our website, voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden's top advisors are reviewing and formulating their policy toward North Korea, which continues to build its nuclear arms program despite many years of varied attempts to curtail the effort. Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton spoke with VOA about North Korea and recent engagement efforts. In the second of three parts, Ambassador Bolton discusses with VOA Korean correspondent Young-gyo Kim about President Biden's potential strategy and China's role.
One of the key choices that Biden team needs to make seems to be whether they should adopt incremental step-by-step approach towards North Korea's denuclearization. Do you think step-by-step approach will work?
No, I don't think step-by-step or action-by-action, as the North Koreans sometimes call it. It's gone through a variety of different labels, but it's basically the same approach. They make a promise to give up their nuclear weapons program, and they take one or two steps to carry that into effect, in exchange for which they get substantial economic benefits, delivery of heavy fuel oil during the Clinton administration, similar kinds of promises during the six-party talks, and now they want the relief of economic sanctions. And so the other parties to the agreement give them the economic relief they want, and then North Korea stops making progress in denuclearization. And there's a reason for that. It's very straightforward. All of the heavy lifting on the North Korean side comes at the end of their agreement, when they someday finally destroy the nuclear program. But the benefits that North Korea gets are all at the front end. In today's case, for example, the lifting of economic sanctions would have an immediate and very positive effect on what's left of the North Korean economy. Once they get steady again, then it becomes easier to evade the remaining sanctions. Their economy is more stable. The military is happier. So they get the benefits up front, and the downside to them comes at the end. Because it's disproportionate, North Korea actually gains strength from the early stages of an agreement. And since they never make it to the later stages of the agreement, these action-for-action programs have invariably worked out to benefit North Korea.
Recently, you wrote an opinion piece. It was titled, Biden Must Focus on China. Biden Must Confront North Korea via Beijing. And there you said it is time for the U.S. to focus on China, and China must now own up to its responsibility. How can the U.S. press China to own up to its responsibility?
Well, I think for many years, the government in the United States, in Democratic and Republican administrations, has said China is working with us to find a solution to the North Korean nuclear program. They hosted the six-party talks during the Bush administration. They try and pose in the press as being helpful to try and bridge the gap between North Korea and the United States. And the U.S. has gone along with that. I think it's time to call off the charade. China has used North Korea ever since the peninsula was partitioned for its own purposes. I mean, we all remember that the two communist parties in China and North Korea used to say they were as close as lips and teeth, very, very close. Certainly in the early days, there's no doubt that Chinese assistance to and Russian assistance to North Korea's missile program and its nuclear program was very important. Now, both Russia and China deny today that they're aiding either the missile or the nuclear program. I have my doubts about that. But the assistance that they gave very early was critical. And given China's economic influence in North Korea, it could still call the shots if it wants to. So we're in a very difficult situation right now between the U.S. and China for a number of reasons, stealing America's intellectual property, probably stealing South Korea's intellectual property, too. So it's not an optimistic time, but it's precisely for that reason that China's responsibility for the existence of the North Korean regime has to be on the bilateral U.S.-China agenda.
Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton speaking with VOA Korean correspondent Young-gyo Kim. Join us tomorrow for Part 3, as North Korea's current threat is discussed and how Trump fell short in direct meetings with Kim Jong-un. Happening now in Asia, ousted Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi was recently charged with breaching a law intended to control the spread of COVID-19, according to her lawyers. She appeared by video link before a judge and is already facing charges of corruption and illegal possession of walkie-talkies. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We hope your day is going well, and we're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. The Biden administration has said it will not be involved in a national vaccine passport system, deferring instead to private companies to implement mechanisms for people to prove they have been vaccinated for travel and other activities. White House correspondent Patsy Wodicka-Swara has this report on why vaccine credentialing is a controversial issue in the United States.
Excited fans returning to New York's Yankee Stadium earlier this month for the first time since October 2019 as the new Major League Baseball season begins. They have to prove that they are coronavirus free.
Just showing the vaccination card after 14 days is good enough. Otherwise, I know people are getting tested.
This week, New York became the first state to offer a digital vaccine passport, a free app and website to prove COVID-free status either through vaccination or a negative COVID-19 test.
We've got to respect people's privacy. We got to make sure that the system is accurate. There's definitely more to be worked through, but I think they'll be part of the solution.
Private companies around the world already use digital vaccine certification in tourism, entertainment, and other industries. Several countries, including China and Israel, have launched official nationwide systems, but don't expect the U.S. to follow.
There will be no centralized universal federal vaccinations database and no federal mandate requiring everyone to obtain a single vaccination credential.
Vaccine certification is controversial in the U.S. Some Republican governors have even issued executive orders banning them.
Americans are often very skeptical of the idea of anything that might be centralized in the federal government, and they see that kind of centralization as being an affront to either privacy or to freedom.
The Biden administration is urging private entities to develop their own solutions, but will provide guidelines to meet certain standards, including accessibility and affordability. Patsy Wodicka-Swara, VOA News.
The U.S. space agency NASA is eyeing the first possible day to launch its flying robot on Mars. Plus, the space agency tests a moon capsule, and the European Space Agency calls for diversity. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us The Week in Space.
Just two buddies out on an interplanetary road trip this week as NASA's Perseverance and Ingenuity rovers posed for a selfie on the red planet. NASA says launching a helicopter from the Martian surface could now be just days away.
Release.
Last July, the space agency sent the Perseverance rover on a months-long journey to Mars spanning almost 55 million kilometers. Perseverance must now find the perfect launch pad for scientists and crew on Earth to test the Ingenuity helicopter. Project manager Mimi Ong says the challenge is chopping through an atmosphere with only 1% of the pressure on Earth.
The first and foremost challenge is to make a vehicle that's light enough, you know, to be lifted. The second is to generate lift. The rotor system has just been very fast.
The Wright brothers achieved the first successful flight in 1903, and NASA is looking to recapture that moment by attempting the first powered, controlled flight on another planet. Meanwhile, NASA conducted a drop test of its next-generation Orion moon capsule in Hampton, Virginia. Orion weighs more than 6,300 kilograms and is part of NASA's Artemis program, which aims to put the first woman and next man on the moon. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
That's our program. Thanks for being with us today for VOA Asia, and join us again at the same time tomorrow. In the meantime, we're online. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Just look us up under our name, VOA Asia. We also thank our VOA Asia team, managing editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead. Be safe. Be well.